Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Since our origins 200,000 years ago, we humans have lived intimately with and among wild animals. We were captivated by their beauty, their intelligence, and their power. It is not coincidence that we worship them as gods, that they were the subjects of our earliest art. The technology of the last 200 years, a mere 1/1000th of our time on Earth, has separated us from that ancient awareness. Does the loss matter? If so, can we do anything to rediscover it? Sculptor and naturalist George Buman has some thoughts. George, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Where'd you grow up?
You know, I grew up in central New York State.
About how far of the city, north of the city?
North of Syracuse by about 20 miles.
Rural, urban?
This was dairy country. Yeah, I grew up in rural country and on the shores of Oneida Lake. Some folks may be familiar with Oneida Silver. That community was on the other end of the lake that I grew up on. And I was really fortunate growing up. That was, I think if I had to do it again, one of the places I would pick again.
Why?
It had that wonderful mix of family ties in the time I was there. Both sets of grandparents were close distance away. My maternal grandparents were a mere 100 yards up the road. And it also had that element of family history to the land. You know, they were, on my mom's side, the second settlers in that part of New York.
That goes back a ways in American history.
Yeah, it sure does. And so to add to that, my maternal grandfather was an amateur archaeologist and historian. So as soon as I could ride a bike, I would ride into town and follow Grandpa around where he gave tours at a museum he started that covered about 10,000 years of human history in that area.
Wow.
And so the landscape was alive. I could see as a child fishing with him, you know, the bateau of Sir William Johnson coming through on the French and Indian War campaigns, and could picture, you know, our earliest ancestors there running the ferry across the river and Samuel Champlain passing through there in a basket after a battle with the Iroquois. So that came from him. And so to me, the landscape and the living environment was alive.
It's too much of a coincidence to think that didn't have an impact on your future career. Is that fair?
I think that's a fair assumption. I grew up in a family where my mother was a sculptor, still is a sculptor, and my father was actually a computer networks engineer.
Where'd you go to school?
You know, I went to college after finishing high school in that area to the College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse, New York.
Okay.
Associated with Syracuse University.
Studying?
I studied forest biology and fisheries.
Why?
That's just what I liked. You know, it just seemed to be the default mode. I loved art. I loved nature. And in my early teens, I thought art was kind of a crazy way to make a living.
And someone might say you were pretty astute.
Yeah, perhaps so. And so I decided to follow my other passion in natural history, and it snowballed from there.
Okay, let's talk about both of them. Let's start with the fact that you're a sculptor. I looked on your website. Your sculptures are mammals for the most part, birds and mammals. Tell me about the origin of your work. Why do you sculpt?
It's interesting. I started sculpting again around the time my dad passed away. You know, ironically enough, my mom needed help to get home to help him with his cancer in that case. And so I helped her on the road to finish some sculpture jobs and was able to help her get back to dad. But at the same time, I realized this makes sense to me. It's still in there.
Hmm.
And I came home from that, and we had not too long before moved to Yellowstone.
When was that?
That was in the early 2000s. We've been here about 15 years.
Okay.
And I came home and told my wife, Jenny, I think I need to try this again. Hmm. You know, as an educator, you know, starting right back with Grandpa and giving tours of the museum starting at 12, I was very verbal and very, you know, interested in sharing ideas and insights with people. But after hitting Yellowstone, I found there are still gaps, you know, things that I couldn't share with a word or a description. I needed something more, and sculpture filled that void for me.
And why Yellowstone? Why did you want to come here?
You know, it's interesting. My wife had worked, whom I met at Virginia Tech, had worked on a wildlife research project in Yellowstone years before. And when I finished my publications and thesis from my master's, I kind of came to the realization that I was done with research. I had something different to give. I wasn't sure what, but I was happy to take that break and basically said to her, wherever you'd like to go, as long as there's some weeds and water and things I can run around in, I will be happy.
Now, Yellowstone's a very different landscape than Oneida, New York. How did it strike you?
My first impression of the Yellowstone area was in July. And driving into Gardner, Montana, where we live now, I thought, my gosh, who would live in a brown town like this? and we love it. It's home now. You know, it is home, truly, but it's very different than the Eastern Green.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with sculptor and naturalist George Buman about his experience with animals. You said that you realized you didn't want to pursue pure research, but remained interested in the field, I'm going to say, of ecology and animals. So what did you do about that?
Yeah, that's right, Brian. It's interesting. It took me to do a full master's program to realize, you know, I love the subject matter. I love being out. I love learning about these wild creatures, their lives. But when I published papers, I found or felt it's me, my colleagues who read this, and very few else. And from my upbringing, it was always steeped in sharing with everybody.
So how do you do that?
Yellowstone has become sort of the method, the way forward in that. You know, it's a place that people, regardless of their initial tendency towards nature and the outdoors, they come with a different perspective. They come ready to experience something. They may not even know what, but that offers me the chance to grab them, so to speak, and draw them into the magic that really is out there, not only in Yellowstone, but where they live too.
Yellowstone attracts people from widely diverse cultures from all over the world. You say you want to grab them. How do you go about grabbing them to get them to see something that you want them to see?
I say I grab them, but I think what more often happens in my preference is that I'm just a facilitator to allow Yellowstone to grab them.
For example?
For example, you know, to look upon someone's face at hearing their first wild wolf howl. You know, that moment where someone has maybe dreamt of that moment or researched, and you know, whatever they've done to build up to that moment, they've sought it.
Now, I heard you give a lecture not long ago, and you are the first person I ever heard, and I've been around a while and in the outdoors and with naturalists and hunters, do what I will call replications of animal sounds. You just said they heard a wolf howl. Can you show us what they might have heard?
Yeah, it's early in the morning, dead calm, and out of that airspace.
Now, I have to ask you, where and how did you learn to do that?
Lots of time alone as a kid. You know, I grew up in a sporting community like a lot of Montana kids, and you know, duck hunting and turkey hunting and, you know, fishing and all those things were part of life. And it, you know, I just gravitated to the ability to have a conversation with an animal.
Now, I'm not going to embarrass myself by asking you to do a duck call because I have enough trouble using a call. So you started doing this as a child?
I did. It was just, I think, like a lot of kids, you make noises and you test your abilities, and see what you can do. And lo and behold, it drew a response.
From the wolves in the neighborhood?
Well, at that time, seriously. It was more often, you know, say, turkeys, for instance, that recolonized that area while I was growing up.
So you call turkey with your mouth.
Yeah, yeah. And
just do one, just for the heck of it. Pretty good. I'll invite you along on my next turkey hunt. All right, so now I know this goes way back, because I have to tell you, when I heard you make these different calls, multiple calls of the same species too, which we're going to get into in a minute, I was quite frankly flabbergasted. I've just not heard anything like it. So let's go back to the Yellowstone. So now people have heard that wolf call in the still morning. What's your sense for what happens to them, if anything?
They're hooked.
Hooked on what?
They're hooked on, the easy thing is to say a place or a point in time, but I genuinely feel like they're hooked into something that they don't always fully grasp, that runs a lot deeper than what we did on a vacation, what we did for a road trip. It grabs them in a way that you have the ability to then open them up to something much more beautiful than an interesting sound in the vacuum of Yellowstone's winter.
Okay, what's the thing that's much more beautiful that you want to open them up to?
The fact that the beauty of nature is around us always, all the time. You can be in a suburb, you can be in a city, you can be in Yellowstone for sure. But a lot of what it means to be human is to have those ties to wild nature.
As I mentioned in my introduction, the need to rediscover that closeness, that affinity, is historically very recent. And yet, it's very strong, because the world we live in is detached from visible interaction with nature more and more and more, from air-conditioned rooms to, I mean, all sorts of things.
Agree.
Given that the strength of the separation, how do you find it? In other words, do you find people are interested in reentering that sort of relationship, are curious, not? What? What do you see?
I think it really runs the gamut. You know, some people come looking for that something. You know, in a place like Montana, a place like Yellowstone serves it up to them on a platter. Where have I been all my life? How come I'm only finding this now? And for others, it still takes time. Wow, neat seeing that geyser go off. What's next? You know. Let me give you an example of the former. You know, we had a woman who came on one of the winter wildlife watching classes that I lead for the Yellowstone Association, and she was at a point in her life where she really wasn't happy. She didn't quite know what the future held for her. She'd gone through schooling and been working in a particular field, and it didn't fill her up. Mm. And something changed in her. And this is not an unusual thing, to see someone come to a realization about themselves in that place. And, you know, I got an email from her a few months later. She'd quit her job, and for her, the right answer was beginning working for an animal shelter. And so she completely changed the direction of her life based upon a few days in the park. And that's a powerful thing to see have happen to a person.
Do you notice any difference between adults and children?
Oh, immensely. Immensely. Children haven't been completely patterned, shall we say, by society. They're still free souls until we educate them. And adults have it figured out. They know the answers. Come along. Let's do this. Let's do that. We haven't done this yet. And the child is pulling at the other end of those arms, wanting to stay and watch the squirrel, wanting to look at those flowers or listen to music. You know, like that Joshua Bell playing in the subway. You know, how many children wanted to stop and listen? And here's one of the world's greatest musicians on earth, playing an incredible musical instrument and this beautiful piece of music, and everybody walks by.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with sculptor and naturalist George Buman about animals. When I heard you render wolf calls and raven calls, one of the points you were making in your talk was, this isn't just random sound. This is language. This reflects intelligence. That opinion would come as a shock to many modern people, but not a shock to traditional people. Tell us about what you know about animal language and intelligence.
Well, it most certainly is language, and it's surprisingly specific. And as you stated, it's no surprise to indigenous cultures. Our own ancestors knew these things. It's our more modern selves that have sort of sloughed them off, if you will. And in my experiences, both growing up where I did and right up into including Yellowstone, as you try to access that inner child, that sense of wonder and awe and see what truly exists out there, you begin to realize the ravens have a word for eagle. They have a call, a word again, if you will, for get out of my neighborhood, speaking to another raven, which is different from one speaking at or towards an eagle. And the wolves have that. Townsend Solitaire has that. All these species have a language, and what's most fascinating to me is how they then overlap. So the robins listen to the deer. The deer listen to the chickadees. The ground squirrels listen to...
When you say they listen, that's different than they hear. Obviously they hear, but you're saying cross-species animals listen and understand what's being said, what's being communicated, like what kind of predator is out there? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying.
For example?
For example, ravens, incredibly intelligent. And when the territory is occupied, you'll hear the territorial pair calling in the morning to let everyone know that status is quo. But if another raven comes into their territory, which is different, noticing the spacing of the notes and the grouping mm-hmm. of the notes and the inflection of the notes compared to this. That incessant, repeated, closely coupled notes is the difference between a raven chasing another raven out of its territory and an eagle being chased out of that same territory.
I think for a lot of people, they'd find that hard to believe. I've spent a lot of time in the woods as a hunter and non-hunting. And I remember thinking as a child, squirrels would tell me where deer were, learning that squirrels would, and they would, it seemed to me, I wasn't saying they were deliberately saying, Brian, there's a deer, but they'd make a certain sound, and pretty soon I'd see a deer. And I began to make the correlation. Jim Corbett is a British, actually of British origin, born in India in 1875, lived in the jungle from his childhood and wrote a series of books, one famous because he hunted man-eating tigers. But if you read the books, here's a guy that was immersed in the jungles, observant, and he wrote in the 1920s about animals, both birds and monkeys, giving different calls for different types of predators. And when I read that, I was astounded. You're telling me you've heard the same.
I have. And it makes sense. You know, earlier in my life, I probably just said, oh, poo. You know, I don't hear that. And it's there. It's there, and it's very relevant. And it makes sense. You know, if the only word you had to say was, run! We would be running all the time. You had one word. You run! What? Well, why am I running? Run! You know, and pretty soon you say, what for? Well, run, if it's a dog, would probably make sense if you'd run as a dog. Run! Here comes a landslide. There are different reasons, and it makes sense for us as biological organisms to conserve energy. Well, I'm not going to run that far. It's a steamroller.
Why does it matter to another raven to be warned that it's a predator on the ground versus the air or anything similar?
It's food's at a premium. It takes incredible amounts of energy to seek out, consume, digest food to nourish yourself, to nourish your young. And so it's like with home insulation. You can increase the heat to raise the temperature in your home, or you can up the insulation. You can prevent loss. And so by preventing the loss of calories that's not that big a deal. Let's just go a little higher in the tree and we won't have to worry about that.
So you're saying animals have evolved communications that are efficient to their survival.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, Brian. A robin has a different alarm call for a great gray owl versus a great horned owl. A red squirrel has a different alarm for a predator on the ground versus a predator in the air. And this becomes part of their, we could call it animal culture. This is part of what it means to be in squirrel community, is to know the language, to understand what the vocalizations mean, and to respond appropriately.
So give us some wolf calls and tell us what they mean.
This can be tough because we're still speculating, but based upon seeing a lot of behaviors happen again and again and hearing the same vocalizations, you can start to pair things together sometimes in your own mind. And so, for instance, a typical chorus howl from a wolf is a long, drawn-out, deep sound. Okay. And at times, a member might get separated from the pack, and you hear a similar vocalization, a little more, it's hard to describe with words, but you might hear something like, versus something like this. It's different. It's shorter. It's clipped almost. And the first time I started putting two and two together with that, it was in association with watching these males from other packs penetrate enemy territory with the interest of finding a date. That's a wolf trying to get a date. He's out there somewhere. He's hiding. He's working through the cover of a enemy territory, trying to elicit a response from the females to draw them to him rather than him go in and risk his life trying to find a mate. And so that short call seems to be associated with them moving about that enemy territory, different patches of cover, vocalizing, moving, vocalizing again, hoping to draw someone to them rather than the reverse.
Clearly, that kind of language and the listening, cross-species listening, intra-species listening, reflects intelligence. That's clear, because they respond to it. Give us other examples of what you would characterize as animal intelligence.
Well, great examples often come from ravens. They're very intelligent creatures, and I might say all animals are intelligent. They're only as intelligent as they need to be. But ravens seem to have an interesting edge. And, for example, they love to follow the snowmobiles in Yellowstone.
Really?
Or they stop at the parking lots where the snowmobiles pause to go walk the geyser basin, for instance. And if you don't cover up your bags well enough, they learn to operate zippers and get into bags and pull strings and before long can have an entire lunch. And
you mean they'll open a bag with a zipper?
Mm-hmm, they will. Yeah, you can watch them do this. We've done it before and had the funny instance once where my wife and I went to Old Faithful on work-related business and prepared our bags, got everything set, thought we'd raven-proof things and went into the visitor center to visit with one of our colleagues. And after walking back out, seeing this snowmobile with dollar bills and credit cards and receipts strewn all over the snow, and what kind of fool would not prepare their bags and cover things up and zip things and buckle them? And as we got closer, I realized it was our snowmobile. So the joke was on us that day, you know, and it's incredible. A friend relayed a story once of a raven rifling through their bags and extracting a pint-sized jar of peanut butter. And think of yourself. Your arms are replaced with wings. You've got a longer beak, but you have to open the peanut butter jar.
Not so easy.
Not so easy. They came back after a walk out to a viewpoint and back. The peanut butter jar was out of the bag. It was open and empty.
Now you have to explain that to me.
Well, it was explained to me later that they repackaged everything. They wanted to see how this raven figured it out. And the bird, as they, you know, retired and went to a spot where they could view from a hidden location, the bird did the same. Opened the bag, rolled it off the pile of others, got the peanut butter jar back out, and with one foot, put the foot on the peanut butter jar and started pecking at the textured rim of the top with its beak. Ironically enough, in a counterclockwise position or direction. And it quickly quit it and flew away. Obviously, must have realized, this is the same jar, and it's empty.
From hearing you before, I know you have many similar stories that illustrate stunning intelligence, it seems to me, on the part of animals, stunning to me. But I go back to my introduction. Does rediscovering any of this really matter in the modern world?
I think it does, Brian. I think it's critical at a time when we strive for connection again. We've built this world around ourselves, and what we've found is that it's quite lonely at times. We need to feel small. We need to feel awed. We need to feel like we're part of something bigger than what's on the payroll sheet, what's on your calendar. To be halted from your routine by long enough to question, was that talking to me? What was it saying? And I think it helps us to remind certainly ourselves, but you know, just humanity in general, that we are part of this bigger picture. This bigger picture is connected. And all the pieces, when moved, affect all the other pieces. And so we and the ravens and the wolves and all these things are various forms of the canary in the coal mine. We're at a point in human history where we've wrought a lot upon this planet to our own desire. And some of it's good. You know, we have hope for that. And some of it less so. And we have the ability to find out how through other eyes.
George Buhman, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. We'll